Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. This week on the show, I have a very frank and open conversation with the lovely Gillian McCollum. Now, I do want to give just a quick warning about this episode that if you have suffered from disordered eating or chronic dieting, or you find hearing about any of these topics triggers or too emotional, then maybe this is the episode to skip. Otherwise, I think these are really important topics that we all need to talk about, that need to be made more mainstream and, you know, just really build that awareness around it. And not only for females, but for males as well, and for people of all ages, right down from our children and teenagers to grown-ups. I've really enjoyed this conversation with Gillian. And Gillian is an anti-diet, food and body freedom coach. She's also a body positive yoga teacher whose mission is to help women find lasting peace and freedom with food and their body. She has a unique approach combining both intuitive eating and body acceptance practices and supports women in their recovery from chronic dieting and navigating emotional eating. So without further ado, let's have a listen in. Hi, I'm Kate Boyle and welcome to the Mind Movement Health Podcast. Each week, I'll be bringing you health information from diet and lifestyle to movement and nutrition. My aim is to bring you bite-sized pieces of information that you can instigate into your everyday life to change your health. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Mind Movement Health Podcast. Gillian, thank you so much for coming on the show this week. I'm super excited to have you on.
Thanks for having me, Kate. I'm excited to be here.
This is one of the topics that's a bit closer to my heart, and I didn't tell you this before I got you onto the show, but I myself growing up suffered quite a bit from disordered eating, being a ex-dancer, having a lot of restrictions and all the rest of it. So I feel passionately about trying to get this information out to other people. And it was really interesting because I was speaking to a close friend of mine who works in the ER in one of the big hospitals here in Australia. And she is in the mental health sort of team there within the ER. And she said to me, please, 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 can you do a podcast episode on disordered eating? Because she said, you would not believe the amount of it that she sees in that comes through as the ER. And it might not be the third, like they're not coming in for that. It's part of it. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But she said it's one of those conditions that people don't realize how many people actually suffer from them. Yeah. So yeah. That was one of the reasons I wanted to have you come on the show.
Oh yeah. I'm so glad to be here and chat about this. It's my favorite subject.
Now, can you share with listeners, you know, a little bit about yourself, share what you do?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm coming to you from Edinburgh, Scotland, which you might detect from the accent. And I work with women who suffer from disordered eating, as you say, and that can be dressed up in all kinds of symptoms like emotional eating, like binge eating, like severe food cravings that can feel like food addiction. So I work with people all over the world. Thankfully, I had an online business before COVID hit. So I'm here in Edinburgh. I live here with my husband and my cat, but I spend my life pretty much on Zoom working with women all over the UK and Australia, America, that kind of thing. I also was fairly new to being online. I'm also a yoga teacher. I'm a body positive yoga teacher, which was historically always in person and then now is also online too. So yeah, it's kind of cool.
You're ahead of the time being online before everybody else.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be too, I have to say. I didn't have to figure all that out back in last March.
Yeah, I wish I was. I have a studio at home. So I've been working at home for 12 years. So I've been ahead of a lot of people and working from home, but wasn't, you know, as far into the online world as you. So I wish that was one area that I had already delved into.
Yeah. For me, it's great because it means that firstly, I can be anywhere in the world and also my clients can be anywhere in the world. So it just gives a lot of flexibility. And also, like, you know, one of the things that comes along with disordered eating is body shame, right? A real lack of body confidence. So working on Zoom can actually be really helpful, both from a coaching perspective and from a yoga perspective, because a lot of my yoga students get into a yoga practice because it means they don't have to come into a studio. They can actually practice with their camera off in the beginning if that's what they feel is most helpful. So it's kind of been an interesting shift from that perspective.
Yeah, and I think that's great. I know when within my studio, because I teach Pilates, but I have four people in the class and everybody does an individualized program depending on their injuries, their posture, etc. But I know when a lot of people start, they're really worried that other people are going to be looking at them. And you know, once they start, they realize, oh no, there's too much going on with you focusing on your own breathing and your own exercises that you just don't have that time. But, you know, it is one of those big things that a lot of people have to overcome. Oh, so yeah. I can see how being online can be helpful.
Oh yeah. And walking through the door is often the hardest thing, right? Like, as you say, once you get into the exercise, you realize that there's so much going on, but it's that getting over the threshold of the door in the first place can be really challenging for folks. And in my work, body image, body acceptance is about 50% of what I do, because for the most part, with only a couple of exceptions, body image, body acceptance, how we feel about being in our own skin is generally the precursor to disordered eating, right? So when I first started out, I didn't work so much around body image and then quickly realized that that was where it was all coming from for the most part.
Yeah. Well, one of my questions I did want to ask is, what are some of the other triggers that might come through that might sort of tip people into that disordered eating?
Yeah, good question. It's dieting tends to be the biggest precursor, right? So whether that's just a kind of really casual kind of, I'm going to be good, I'm going to just, you know, lose a couple of pounds for holiday, whatever it is, that is how it generally speaking begins. And the other time I see it is when people just feel like their life's out of control and food is something that they can control. Like, we are sold this idea that if we control our food, we can control our body and then we can control our life. That seems to be the kind of linear thinking with this stuff. And that isn't true, but it gives us that sense of security, right? So I think the statistics off the top of my head is something like 35% of just like your normal kind of casual dieter turns into like proper chronic dieting, like pathological chronic dieting. So it's a fairly high number from what something seems really benign and really casual that you can just dip in and out of. 35% of those people, it becomes a lifelong mission, basically. And of those people, about a quarter of them actually develop a full-blown eating disorder. So it's pretty, yeah, it's pretty rife.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's 35%, it's at least one in three people. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, definitely more prevalent than I would have thought. And even you just touching on that control issue, I know for me, but when I developed my disordered eating in my teenage years, it was around control. I had, you know, there were issues going on at home. Do you know what I mean? I had injuries with dance. There was, do you know what I mean? There was a whole lot of stuff going on that obviously I couldn't control. And I didn't know and realize that at the time. But yeah, it was a way, I guess, of how I thought I could cope to get through those situations, and not the best way, yeah, clearly, yeah, but the only way I guess I knew how at that young age,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. So that's how it generally always begins, right? It's a coping mechanism, and it works until it doesn't work for the most part. The other thing that I see as well, and maybe this is what you are touching on, the other kind of, I guess you maybe want to say like personality trait or other kind of symptoms that I see, is people who suffer from generalized anxiety, right? So really caught up in like people pleasing, perfectionism, those kind of traits. I've probably yet to work with someone who doesn't have generalized anxiety out with food and body, because food and body symptoms they are symptoms of anxiety, right? That's like how they manifest. The anxiety manifests into, so what can I control? Just as you say, if life feels out of control, what can I control? And we cling on to food to control our body, to control our life.
Yeah. And I know for myself, I ended up developing a lot of digestive issues and things that came along with that as well. And that took a long time to work through even that health side of it as well. So I'm sure you see a lot of that potentially happening too.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you mentioned that, because gastrointestinal issues are huge for people with disordered eating. And a lot of the time people think that in order to solve their digestive issues, it's about control around food, right? If I can pin down what's causing these problems and restrict and control harder, that's going to be the solution. But often what we see, what a lot of the data shows us, is that it's that control and restriction in the first place that's actually causing the GI issues, right? The statistics are huge. I don't know off the top of my head, but last time I read was something like 95% of people with GI issues, it could be traced back to control around food. So yeah, it's a real big one that I see.
Yeah, I can definitely attest to that. And I mean, part of that I know was that, you know, you're anxious, you're holding on to the muscles of your abdominals so hard. I know from me, part of that was, and then that leads to feeling uncomfortable and bloating and all of that stuff that goes with it. So yeah, speaking from experience, that's how I felt around it anyway. Now, can you explain a little bit, you know, people may be sort of tuning in going, yeah, I've been dieting and all the rest of it, but how do we sort of know when we've gone from dieting and sort of restriction to swapping over to disordered eating, sort of crossing that line essentially?
Yeah, it's a good question, because, you know, the statistics around the success, you can't see me, but the quote unquote success of dieting, right, is tragically low. Like, I think, you know, anybody that intentionally loses weight is between 95 and 98% likely to regain that weight within 5 years. And I think a third to two thirds of those people put more weight on than when they began. So for the most part, if you are invested in dieting, it's generally yo-yo dieting, right? Almost all diets are yo-yo diets. If you're invested in controlling your food and your body, it's not, for the most part, a one-time thing, because the vast majority of people, it's just not possible to lose weight for the long term. So what happens is it just becomes this never-ending kind of pursuit. Certainly, I work with people of all ages, probably from late 20s, but right through to like mid to late 60s, right? And there's still people like chasing this thin ideal. So that's the first thing to recognize, is that, you know, casual dieting can very, very quickly move into something more serious. And I would say that line is when you start to see your quality of life decline, right? The reason that most people embark on a diet or weight loss is to improve their quality of life, to maybe improve their health, to become more body confident, whatever the reason is, it's a pursuit to enhance health. Once you get to a point where you realize that actually the majority of your thoughts is around food and body preoccupation, once you realize that you're starting to miss out on social occasions because you're so self-conscious about your body, you're too worried about like breaking your diet, once your mental health starts to really suffer, like once you start to really feel like there's so much guilt and shame around what you're eating and what you're doing, and just generally when things start to feel out of control, one of the things that I work with mostly, I would say, is people who suffer from binge eating. So what I see is this like binge restrict cycle, right? This like really doubling down on the diet, huge restriction. And then it swings so far in the other direction that people go through episodes of binge eating that is so painful, both physically and emotionally, right? So I'd say once you start to see any of those things, once your quality of life is starting to suffer, and you're having to dedicate a lot of time to this, and once you start to see those missed opportunities, and that's like that's for me personally where I just felt in my sort of health journey, I just realized that when my life started to revolve around this stuff, it was just like, and that was for 15 years. And I was like, if I'm not nailing this by now, is the rest of my life just going to be in pursuit of this? And that's when I just realized, yeah, this has gone too far.
Yeah, I can definitely relate back to there were times where I would get so anxious about having to go out and knowing that there wouldn't be things that I would consider appropriate for me to eat that I wouldn't want to go to the event. Like, I just wouldn't. And sort of bringing up, you were talking about the binge eating, I was almost the reverse in the sense that I would get so hungry, but I couldn't decide on what to eat. And I would get so upset that I would not eat anything because I was sort of caught in this cycle of being so hungry, but not wanting to eat anything, not being able to work out what to eat. So I wouldn't eat. And that went on for quite a while. So rather than the binging, I kind of just, went the other way.
You just doubled down on the restriction. Yeah. Yeah, we get so confused by like what to eat when we put these rules in place, right? It becomes really, it sounds to me like it just became really overwhelming for you and it was best just not to make that decision at all. I definitely see that in my work for sure. Talking of like not going to social events, one of the times I knew it crossed the line was like when I went to my parents-in-law for Christmas dinner and I took my own Tupperware with my own food in it. And I was just like, yeah, this is no longer about health.
Yeah. So segueing from that, because I don't want to, do you know what I mean? This can be pretty heavy. It is heavy stuff. And I can laugh about it now because I'm on the other side of it. And I've had to do a lot of work to get through that other side. But, you know, if people are listening, it's not a laughable topic. And, you know, even today, there are times where I have to pull myself, you know, don't be overcritical, don't sort of really overthink that, you know, I don't weigh myself because I know for me that if I start weighing myself, then that's a trigger that I will then get too focused on that. So, you know, I have things in place, I guess, that sort of help me to continue to sort of stay healthy and not get back into that mindset. But what are the sort of things that you might recommend or work with your clients to sort of maybe one, stop them if they think they're sort of heading into that direction, you know, what they can do to stop that. And if they already have gone into that and they're on the other side, how they can sort of prevent a relapse.
Yeah. So I would say that one that you've named actually, like not weighing yourself, I think is a great first step. That's generally what I would say to my clients. Like, firstly, what are your, what I call your tools of dieting, right? So it might be the bathroom scales, might be the kitchen scales, weighing food. It might be a measuring tape. It might be a fitness tracker. It might be kind of not being able to walk past a shop window and see your reflection, you know, like that body checking kind of piece. I would have my client bring to their attention, what are they using as it's a tool of measurement. Sometimes it's like a pair of jeans. It's like, I feel okay within myself if I can fit into these jeans. And if I can't, I'm not okay. Those measurement systems are something that you can, you know, just get rid of. Just stop using those as to determine your sense of self-worth to begin with. But the underlying, like once we look beneath that, right, that's like a very surface level yet quick thing that you can do. But then it's like, well, that feeling of not being safe, right, in your own body, just feeling like, well, then how am I going to know if I'm okay? How am I going to know my weight? How am I going to know my clothing size or anything like that? That is really our own, like, it's our own internalized fat phobia, right? It's like fighting against, like I talk to my clients about having a natural set point weight. We're all born with a weight range that we, if we let go, we don't control our food. We just let our food happen to us and we have a relaxed, peaceful relationship with food and we're taking care of ourselves in the best way, right? So we're moving our body. We are trying to manage our stress levels, doing what we can, our body will land at where it is supposed to genetically land. And fighting against that generally means that we have this underlying bias inside us that all bodies are supposed to be thin and I can only be okay with myself if I'm thin. And actually, when you look at bodies across the world, we are all different shapes, sizes, skin colors, heights. Like we are all different and, you know, brilliantly so, but we have a really hard time embracing that. And I think that's down to our culture, right? That is down to what is sold to us through media, through any kind of consumerism, you know, the fashion industry, even the medical industry being so invested in BMI, which, as we know, is just a very, very flawed measurement of trying to measure somebody's health, right? Our weight does not dictate our health. There are people in this world in very small bodies who are not healthy. And then there are people in bigger bodies who are healthy, right? Our health, we can pursue health and engage in health promoting behaviors, no matter what body size we're in. But I think so many people just don't believe that and believe that in order to be healthy, they have to be thin. So therefore they pursue weight loss rather than pursuing health. Those are two different things. And my pursuit of thinness did not result in, you know, better health. And I see that for a lot of my clients. How are we defining health? You know, a thin body, but completely obsessed with how we look and our food and not engaging with the world because we're so scared. Yeah, I know that was a long answer to your question.
No, but you're right. Like, you know, every day we're faced with, you know, the body images, whether or not you're jumping on social media or you're turning the TV on or you're looking in a magazine, you know, I think the narrative is slowly changing and it's sometimes, you know, nice to see that change. And there may be bigger models or, you know, different skin colors and stuff have started to, I guess, be a bit more present, but it is very slow. And I know as a mum that I'm worried for my two girls. I've got two young girls and I'm very aware of that. And you try to sort of vet what they're being exposed to, but you can't check everything, you know, when they're at school and they're with their friends or, you know, what they're talking about and what they're, you know, sort of, I don't know, maybe watching at home and then telling my girls to watch and all those sorts of things. So do you have any advice for parents that maybe bringing up, not even just girls, but girls and boys around body image and, you know, loving your body and that kind of things?
Yeah,
that may help.
Definitely. And you're right. Like this kind of food and body issues have historically been, you know, issues that affect girls and women because we have been kind of socialized to believe that how we look is our important and most valued kind of asset in the world, right? But because this is so driven by consumerism, capitalism, we have definitely seen a shift in this kind of stuff affecting boys and men, you know, and trans people and non-binary people. It's kind of like, you know, let's broaden the market as to who we can target around this stuff. So definitely I would, you know, I think that can be, we can miss the mark sometimes if we think that this only affects girls because it really doesn't. You know, when you look at the statistics, I think the most prevalent age group for eating disorders are somewhere between the age of 13 and 17. That's the most prevalent age. That's when kids are at their most vulnerable, right? And they're most impressionable when they move through puberty and body starts to change and there's a lot of pressure on how they look. I'm not a parent, but I do work with a lot of parents who ask this same question. And I would say, you know, yes, your kids are going to move out into the world, consuming media and being influenced by other people, but the culture that you create and promote at home cannot be underestimated. That is essentially the place of safety that they're going to come back to no matter what's happening in the world. And if you as a parent can promote a culture of inclusivity, that all bodies are worthy bodies, right? One of the things that I see a lot and I don't think it's helpful is when kids maybe get bullied and being called fat, right? The word fat is just so, it's just so weaponized, particularly in the playground with kids. And, you know, kid comes home crying, so-and-so called them fat. And what I see is parents saying to their kid, you're not fat, you're beautiful. And that's really, really dangerous, because what that's saying is it's bad to be fat, right? And that narrative is dangerous, because what makes people gain weight, we have this impression that it's like bad behavior, we're not looking after ourselves. But truthfully, there's a whole lot of things that affect our body weight. A lot of the people that I work with, you know, have diabetes or PCOS or, you know, just generally medication that they're on for, you know, like thyroid issues or whatever. There's a whole slew of things. Trauma is one of the biggest things that can affect our weight. This isn't, you know, our weight is not, you know, because of our behavior necessarily. So to say to our kids, you know, that essentially reinforcing that bigger bodies are bad bodies and that bigger bodies can't be beautiful is a really dangerous kind of narrative to be perpetuating. We need to be more inclusive, and we need to be having kids focus on, you know, how brilliant their bodies are, regardless how they look. So trying to decenter, especially for girls, because this is how we've been raised, that their appearance isn't everything, and that actually, as a whole person, they've got so much more to offer the world than just how they look.
Yeah. We definitely try to foster that in our house. I think it's just, do you know what I mean? It's one of those things that you continually try to work on. And I, as a parent, you always kind of maybe second guessing yourself and thinking, am I phrasing it the right way? Am I doing the right thing? So, you know, I know we're on the right track. So it's always nice to hear somebody sort of reinforce that as well. But, you know, that is one of the big things that we say to our girls, that everybody's beautiful no matter what their size, shape, you know, and anything. It's, yeah, you know, and we're all the same. But it was very interesting. I know my friend that was working in the ER, she said just the language around body image she was referring to. And she said, you know, Kate, the ladies come in and she said, all they want to be is thin. So she said their whole mindset is about losing weight and being thin. And she said, and when we see these issues with males, she said, all they talk about is wanting to be big, to be strong. And they refer back to, oh, when I was that weight, as in bigger and heavier, they felt better about themselves. And the women is always the opposite. Yeah. So, you know, she was just sort of saying how that narrative between male and female was very different around body image too.
Yeah, very gendered, right? This idea that a woman or a girl is to look a certain way, and you're, and also society rewards that, truthfully. Like this is a systemic issue. We do reward thinner bodies. And when it comes to guys, we do reward that kind of alpha male, kind of muscular physique. So this, you know, this is such a broader cultural issue as to what we perpetuate. But in the home, we can definitely try to break those kind of gender stereotypes, I think, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And she was sort of saying too, she's like, you know, even if you take it that step further, you know, she's like, the guys wanted to be bigger, like raising them up, and the women wanted to be thinner and smaller, like going down. Yes. So she was like, it was, you know, diving deeper. She's like, you know, you can dive deeper into everything. But, you know, I know she was sort of explaining it, saying how that was kind of a light bulb moment for her being exposed to this. And as she was sort of, you know, talking about it and getting deeper into it, I was just sort of like, yeah, that is true. We just don't maybe delve into that as much sometimes.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, when we are trying to shrink our bodies, we are shrinking our life. You know, we truly are. We're shrinking our potential as people. That's what I firmly believe. Like when I was at my thinnest, I was, you know, the most miserable, the most underconfident. I had such self-esteem issues. And honestly, I couldn't focus on anything because I was hungry. I couldn't perform in anything, both physically in terms of, you know, exercising, but also professionally. I couldn't focus and concentrate and do well at what I wanted to do because I was hungry, and I was too worried about what I was going to eat for lunch as opposed to, you know, friendships and my career and, you know, like, because I'm a yoga teacher as well, like that was probably the thing that broke that sort of mindset of restriction, because I started to see that actually I didn't have to shrink my body in order to be, to respect my body and for it to be strong and do all these different things for me. And actually what I found was when I actually improved my relationship with food, I was able to do so much more in my life.
Yeah.
You know?
Which is amazing. I was going to say, as a nutritionist, I can honestly say the majority of the time when I am working with somebody, especially women, I tend to actually add more food in to their diet than take food out.
Yeah.
So, you know, majority of people usually come to a nutritionist to, you know, it's generally there's some sort of weight loss that's wants to happen. But the majority of the time, I will say for them, you know, big part of the women that I see, I'm actually putting more food into their diet than saying, you're eating too much food, we've got to take this out.
We're really bad at as human beings to like not do something. You tell somebody not to do something, like don't eat this, don't do that. That's all we want to do. Whereas adding in, that's definitely the model of care that I, you know, work with, is like, what can we add in? Just because you maybe have like some fries, it doesn't mean that the broccoli doesn't have goodness in it, right? Like, yes, have the fries, but like, you know, have the broccoli, have the carrots. It doesn't mean that, you know, we have this real black and white thinking of something is either healthy or it's unhealthy. Whereas actually, like, how we relate to food in that mindset is probably the unhealthiest thing that we can do. Relax around food, enjoy food. We forget that food is to be like enjoyable, right? We're so based on like what it's going to do for us, as opposed to like, can we enjoy it? Can we relax around it? Can it be pleasurable? We forget it's meant to be.
Yeah. And you touched on earlier about peaceful eating, and it sort of stood out because I loved that phrase of peaceful eating. So how do you sort of work with your clients, or what advice can you give to people to try to foster that sort of sense of having that peace with what they're eating and their food intake?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I think about identifying what rules you have around food, right? I often have my clients write out what the rules are. And sometimes like most of the time, they just don't make any sense. They're kind of like a whole combination of like every diet they've ever been on. And when you start to write them out, you just see how contradictory and how, you know, how they just don't make sense and how they're not serving us either. So definitely trying to do away with the rules and working on our own internal fat bias. As I say, like, can we start to dismantle our own internalized fat phobia? And those two things, like when I first started out, as I said to you, I didn't do a whole lot of body image work. And what I found was asking clients to like honor their hunger and get rid of the rules and get rid of those tools of dieting that I spoke about earlier. They only got so far with that until this fear of weight gain just took over. So, you know, that's really the biggest tip, I guess I would say, is that if you're going to work on your relationship with food, you really also need to be working on your relationship with your body and this like fear of weight gain. Because even if you're not in a bigger body, right? So if you're in a bigger body, there's this kind of fear of like not being able to lose weight. But if you're in a smaller body, you can still live with the fear of gaining weight. So it's not like that. It's not like having internalized fat phobia only affects people in bigger bodies. It hugely affects people in smaller bodies because they live in fear of gaining weight. So let's like work on that as well as trying to dismantle all the rules that keep us stuck and fearful around food.
Yeah. So there is a lot of work that somebody needs to do around this. So generally, do you recommend that someone, if they're sort of, you know, maybe they're listening to this, maybe they've known for a while that they've had some issues, would you suggest them, you know, trying to find somebody to work with like yourself? Like, what would be the first sort of point of call for them to take an action?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what resources people have available to them, right? I personally tried to do a lot of this work on my own for a long time through reading books. So, you know, if your listeners are interested in more of a self-help route, then I would definitely start to read about intuitive eating. That's, you know, that's what my work is based on, intuitive eating principles, and start reading about not necessarily body positivity, because I think that isn't really the whole picture. That's become very diluted. I would say more body acceptance and body liberation is the kind of things that your listeners need to be reading about, maybe listening to podcasts. You can definitely do that. Follow people on social media. But what I found personally was when I started working with a coach, my progress was huge compared to going down the self-help route, because we can't see what we can't see, right? And you'll know this as a nutritionist, like working with someone, people can't see where they're getting stuck. And that's why when you work with someone else, it's like having a mirror held up in front of you, right? For things to kind of not just be pointed out, but because a lot of my clients come to their own realizations when we start working together, right? And start talking about this stuff, they start to realize themselves where they're getting stuck. So if you can work with someone, whether that's like a nutritionist, a dietitian, or a coach, definitely someone who is that I would term as being non-diet or anti-diet. I think working with someone who's very, very invested in weight loss, you're generally not going to repair your relationship with food underneath that premise, right? That framework, because it's the dieting and it's the pursuit of weight loss that for the most part has probably led to the problem. So the solution can't really be found in weight loss or dieting. It really needs to be found in more of a healing and acceptance route, healing the relationship with food, not really about, you know, what you're eating and what you're not eating. So yeah, that would be my recommendation. If you can, if you have the resources, work with someone.
Yeah, you brought up a lot of good points. I mean, it's like anything, you know, you can start learning the piano, but if you start with a piano teacher, just getting that feedback, you do see that progress grow along. So I think, you know, any coach in any area of your life, you tend to take those bigger leaps. And you brought up sort of the fact that you can't see what you can't see. And I know working with some of my clients, they'll, you know, when I'm chatting to them, they'll tell me what they think the issue is. So they'll tell me why they think they can't lose weight and all the rest of it. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, that's actually not the reason. When we look at the bigger picture and we delve in deeper, and maybe I'm delving into, you know, their blood test results or whatever, you know, there are other issues that maybe they can't see, or maybe they don't have the expertise in that area, you know, and the information at hand too. So I think that's where working with an expert can really help too.
Yeah. And you've just made a great point there about how, like, there could be a whole other host of stuff at play that might mean that they, you know, are gaining weight or whatever it is. But as individuals, we put the blame on ourselves, right? It's like, I'm doing something wrong. And generally speaking, that's not the case. Like, our bodies have an intelligence that we often do not have control over. And that kind of blame and shame and guilt doesn't help the situation, right? So, like, definitely when I work with clients, so much of this is about self-compassion. You know, how can we be kinder to ourselves? I think we think that, like, beating ourselves up is going to, like, make us change our behaviors, and it truly doesn't. Like, you know, I always use the analogy that, you know, if your kid came home from school crying because they failed a maths test or something, like, beating them up for it isn't going to make them pass the test next time. You're going to nurture them, and you're going to be like, let's look at this. What can we do? Like, it's okay. You're going to be kind to them and supportive to them, but we don't do that to ourselves because we think it's motivation, and it really isn't motivation. We take best care of the things that we love.
Yeah, you've kind of hit the nail on the head there, really, by saying that. And, you know, circling back to sort of how you were saying, working with somebody that, you know, if you're going to work with somebody that's focusing on weight loss, it's not going to be the right fit too. I know a lot of my clients, when we are working through the nutrition plan, I'll often give them some recipes to try. And quite a few of them will say, but it doesn't tell me how many calories there are in that meal and how many grams of this, that, and the other. And I said, but that's not the aim of you know, this exercise of working with a nutritionist. Our aim is to improve your health, but our aim is to not work on, you know, how many calories are in this and focus on that restriction. But it always surprises me, especially how many people ask for a calorie breakdown when it comes to recipes and food plans and things.
Yeah, that's how we see food these days.
Yeah, which is a terrible shame because there is so much healthy food, like things like avocados and olive oil and stuff like that, that are going to be high in calories because they're good fats. But, you know, the nutrient density in those foods is so nourishing for our body that if we feed ourselves that, you know, we're going to be so much healthier and feel better both mentally and physically that it shouldn't really matter how many numbers it says is, you know, calorie wise in it.
And also it's kind of deflecting again, like so much of my work is based on like trying to move away from these external cues, these external directives of what we should be eating and actually tap into like, are we hungry? What are we hungry for? Like, what seems interesting to us? What would our body love right now? We disconnect from those internal cues, right? And that's where a lot of like the yoga, the body image work and the food work that I do comes together in that, can we actually start to get back in relationship with our body and trust that our body knows what it's doing? Trust our hunger, trust our fullness, and seek out food that's really nourishing for us, as opposed to feeling like we cannot be trusted and we need to make these decisions based on external information like numbers on a packet.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all that. And it's definitely what I try to work with my clients. But, you know, it is a journey and it does take time. Yes. And I always say to my clients that, you know, you're not going to get it right every time and that's okay. Yeah. But you can revisit that decision, examine it, think about why you might have made that decision instead. And then you're prepared a little bit more for the next time that it may occur. So I think it's just one of those things that everyone's constantly evolving and the journey may be a little bit different for everybody and it may take a while too. So not to beat yourself up that you're not getting it right every time.
Oh, yeah, for sure. It's a process of, well, I call it a process of unlearning all of the kind of, as I say, like rules and, you know, stuff we've layered on over the years and shedding that and coming back to like how we're just meant to be around food. Like kids know when they're hungry, kids know when they're full, you know, like, can we get back to that before we start to pile on all the shame and all the, as you say, like numbers and everything like that? That's really what I mean around peace with food. If you can have that internal trust, knowing that like your compass is internal, nothing on the outside is really going to tell you what you need when and in what way. We kind of have the best system built in inside us, right? And that's, I think, where you get most peace from and relaxation from, when you know that actually you can be trusted to make decisions.
Yeah, it's just listening to that, isn't it, sometimes? Yeah. All right. Now, can you share with listeners? I always like to sort of finish off with our guests giving one piece of health advice that our listeners could sort of take away and instigate today. So is there anything that sort of springs to mind that you'd love to share with listeners?
Yeah, I would say I would ask them to get really curious and really honest about their relationship with food. So as I say, we're so caught up in what's right, what's wrong, what's healthy, what's unhealthy, but what's your relationship with food like? How do you think and feel about food? You know, is it based in punishment and restriction and self-loathing? Are those health-promoting behaviors? And might your relationship with food and your body be more important than the food itself or your weight? What's the relationship like? That's the part I think we miss. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I agree, because I think so much of the time, you know, we eat because it's the time, it's lunchtime, so we should eat. Or do you know what I mean? I've been reading a book that's it's called Glow 15. So it's talking about trying to maximize our longevity essentially through our diet. And she talks about protein cycling. And I don't know if listeners are sort of familiar with that, but protein cycling, essentially she talks about intermittent fasting, and on the low protein days, you're limiting obviously the amount of protein that you're eating, and you're only eating within an 8-hour period. And you cycle these days, you have a high day and a low day. And even just me reading that book and knowing what my routine is, knowing that I have to teach, and some days, you know, I've got 8 hours of teaching and they're back-to-back days, you know, I read it going, this plan sounds amazing, but for my lifestyle, it's not going to fit in, because I've got some days where I'm working long hours. I, you know, have an exercise class or something booked in on those days. So having an intermittent fasting day with a low protein, it's not going to work. But this, there would be plenty of people, and, you know, you read it thinking, oh, this is the guide to follow. This is what she's telling me. But having that sort of intuition and knowing, hey, this is a great plan, but it's not going to fit my lifestyle. You know, I have to stop and check that and think about that. But I, you know, I can definitely relate to the point that you're sort of bringing up, that we sort of feel like we read these things. And even when I give my meal plans to my client, I always say to them, this is a guide. This is an idea. You need to adapt this to your schedule, to your lifestyle, with your family, when you cook, you know, these are just ideas. And I think, you know, for a lot of people that can be sort of hard to work out.
And it's interesting you say about how like that plan isn't going to work for my lifestyle, because I just feel like if we're talking about longevity, right, we know that the one of the biggest influencers of chronic illness and disease is stress, right? I think, I don't know what it's like in Australia, but in the UK, it's something like 90% of all doctor's appointments are dealing with people's conditions that are born through stress, right? Chronic stress. So if that's one of the biggest problems in our culture, I can't think of anything more stressful than trying to commit to a plan that isn't going to work for our lifestyle. Like, you know, like trying to follow a certain level of protein when you're teaching 8 hours a day, I can't imagine anything more stressful than that. And then adding onto that, the guilt and the shame if you don't get it right and you don't stick to it, right? So I think we need to think broader about what health actually is. And is it about the ability to stick to a plan, or is it actually about peace and relaxation around food? And by definition, then lowering our stress levels and increasing our sense of self-worth. I think we really underestimate those things.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I was reading that book because, being the nutrition nerd I am, I love, do you know what I mean? I love seeing what else is out there. I love seeing what people are now promoting, you know, for longevity, and what their sort of, you know, suggestions are for it. And intermittent fasting is obviously a very big thing that I always get asked about. So I'm always fascinated to look into and see what works for other people. But again, I'm always adapting them to suit me and my lifestyle, because when you stick to someone else's plan, it doesn't always follow through.
No, definitely not.
Now, where can listeners reach out, connect with you, work with you, all of your, you know, social tags and website?
Yeah. So in terms of social, I'm like more active on Instagram. So it's just my name, Gillian McCollum. So Gillian with a G. And my website's the same, gillianmccollum.com. That's where you'll find both all my information about coaching. I work with folks one-to-one, but also I have a group program that I do 4 times a year, and you will find details of all my yoga stuff online and in person, and I do some on-demand stuff there as well. So yeah, that's where you'll find it, gillianmccollum.com. I also, if any of your listeners are interested, around every kind of 6 weeks, I run a free masterclass. So I've done ones on like emotional eating, binge eating, body image. And my next one is on how to begin an intuitive eating practice. And those are totally free, and they're generally about 60 minutes and then a Q&A afterwards. So details of those are always on my website.
Cool. I'll link them up like to a link in the show notes too, so listeners can get to that as well. So
hey, thank you so much.
That will be great. Thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you on, and lovely to delve into these type of topics that I think sometimes maybe aren't discussed. You know, sometimes it's hard to find information out there, and it's just lovely to talk to an expert within the field, but also have this sort of open and free conversation too. So thank you so much for coming
on. Thanks for having me, Kate.
Thanks for listening into the podcast. Please hit subscribe to be updated for each time we release a new podcast.